Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello. My name is Stephen Schaefer, and it's my honor to introduce the AAMP podcast audience to our newest co-host, Dr. Leanna Blanchard. Leanna, welcome aboard. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here. I'm excited about it.
We're excited as well. It's great to have a new voice on the podcast, and let's just start off by introducing you to the audience. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I did my doctor of physical therapy degree from George Washington University and stayed on for an additional year to complete the orthopedic residency through GW and the Johns Hopkins Hospital Joint Program. I then moved back to Chicago and completed a fellowship in manual therapy at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I also got into the realm of oncology rehabilitation and became a certified lymphedema therapist as well. So I'm trying to blend my orthopedic and oncology knowledge. I now mentor in the Northwestern University Fellowship in Manual Therapy and made the switch to full-time academia this past January. So I am learning how to work at a desk job and enjoying a nice long commute. But I'm also practicing clinically with the Physical Therapy Academy on a contract basis.
Thank you for that introduction. That all sounds exciting and actually maybe more exciting than my life right now. I'm mostly just working in a clinic and I still, of course, have some research projects going on. And I guess most notably right now, I'm helping a team of experts work on a clinical practice guideline for temporomandibular disorders. But the other thing that has me really excited right now in my life is, of course, I'm going to go to my first AAMP conference in person since COVID started. As everyone should know, I'm over the border in Canada, so travel's been a little bit complicated, and I'm looking very much forward to getting back in the mix with everybody.
Yeah, that'll be great. Really looking forward to conference this year as well.
Well, and following on a similar theme to that, what has you excited about joining the podcast team?
That's a great question. I think this is a really unique opportunity to serve the profession and one that I'm very excited about participating in. I think it's also a great opportunity for me as a self-described lifelong learner to get to learn from some really amazing people in our field and get to have great conversations with them. And I just really appreciate the value of a good podcast. As I said, my commute is really long right now, so I have definitely fallen in love with the art of the podcast.
Well, that makes us two peas in a pod. I am, of course, not just because of the AAMP podcast, but in general, a huge podcast fan. I'm one of those weird people that don't have a TV at home, etc. So I get my content constantly from the podcast format. And, you know, I'm going to hold you accountable to you liking a good podcast, because that means you're going to have to do a good job here, which I have no doubt about. And on that note, let me just say for the record, this is just about our four-year anniversary since we went live with the first interview, and a few of us did about a year's worth of work in the background prior to that point, so I feel a bit like a podcast dinosaur right now. I've been around for 5 years. I don't know how long I'll be around in the future, but I do look forward to still recording and still hanging out with everybody and trying to make as good of a product as I can as we move forward.
I think there's a lot to look forward to.
I agree. And all of those points having been made, I think that was a great but brief introduction to you as you join the podcast team. I know you're going to bring a strong, informed voice to the podcast, and I'm eager to see where that leads us.
Thank you. I'm excited.
Welcome to the AAMP podcast. My name is Leanna Blanchard, and I am really excited here today to have Seth Peterson with us. Dr. Peterson received his undergraduate degree in biology from Luther College and his DPT from A.T. Still. He completed his orthopedic residency at A.T. Still
and then an Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapy Fellowship through Evidence in Motion. He is the founder of The Motive, which is a private practice, and The Movement Brainery, a source of continuing education and mentorship for physical therapists. He also holds a position as adjunct faculty at AT Still. Dr. Peterson has been a guest of our podcast multiple times, and we are excited to have him back. Today, we will be discussing his recently published paper, Who Writes This Stuff? Musculoskeletal Information Quality and Authorship of Popular Health Websites, a Systematic Review. Welcome, Dr. Peterson. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Leanna?
I am doing great. It is a lovely Friday here in Chicago, and I am excited to talk to you about this paper today.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
Of course. I thought we'd maybe just get started. If you could tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this review, what got your wheels turning? Why did you decide this was something you wanted to look into?
Oh man. I mean, we all have patients that, you know, I'm sure come in with these, you know, misinformed ideas that oftentimes they get from the internet. So I'm not the first person to think of a study to look at the information quality of the internet. It's basically been done since the internet's been around. It's crazy. But what prompted this interest in me was I had a patient that come in that brought in information from the Mayo Clinic's website, actually. And I was looking at it for lumbar spinal stenosis and like, this is not the best quality information. So that's the Mayo Clinic. So I started thinking, well, you know, what is the quality here? And I looked at the studies that have been done. And really, they hadn't looked at, you know, highly trafficked websites, which is one of the things that we did. And they hadn't really looked at things that might have influenced the information quality, like the authorship of these websites. And then if you think about the context, this was during the COVID pandemic. And so it was kind of, you know, misinformation was a big topic. So yeah, that's what prompted the interest in this.
That sounds like a great background. And I think we've, myself included, all had patients that come in with information and you think, what in the world is going on? This should be reputable and reliable, but it's not. So can you tell us a little bit about the Trust It or Trash It tool that you used? I'm not familiar with this.
Yeah, it's actually a consumer-facing tool. It was developed by the Access to Credible Genetics Alliance. So I guess misinformation quality must be a big deal in genetics. Which is a group that's partnered with the CDC. So there are a lot of tools out there. I mean, people have used different tools for this. And so we wanted to do something a little bit different. It's just a little bit different. It's directed towards the consumer. So we thought that would be kind of interesting. Because of that, though, we did have to adapt it a little bit.
Interesting. I guess in knowing that it is consumer facing and considering the average ability of the consumer to understand medical writing or health literacy even, do you feel that the tool is most likely used accurately by people, or do you think that it would be challenging to use? Because to me, it seems that it would require someone to be able to tell whether author experience is relevant and be able to determine what is an appropriate source or what is not. And I know sometimes even as a very trained healthcare professional, that can be challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. You know, they have a website and people can go to it. It's trustortrash.org. And it's a little bit different. It kind of guides you through. So you can, you know, it'll ask you like a phase one question, you know, is the author listed somewhere on the website? And then it'll kind of guide you through it a little bit differently than how we operationalized it for our study. So it's, I think, maybe a little bit easier than, you know, how we operationalized it. But yeah, I mean, I think you bring up a good point with health literacy. Even then, it's probably still going to be a little bit tough for people, you know, to be looking at references and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's a unique challenge that we face, especially as you mentioned with misinformation really being front and center in the last few years. I think that it's a challenge really for all healthcare providers and making sure that our patients get the information that they need, but that they are able to tell what is quality and what is not, and being able to use that information that they bring to us and information that we want to provide to them and make sure that those things are concordant.
It's tough.
So I found your paper really interesting, and I was honestly a little surprised that no one had looked at this before now. And I appreciated that you looked at credibility, accuracy, and consistency, because I think even within the profession, we've shown that we're not always great at offering the same standard of practice. And I think that's something that AAMT is really working to change. But so I really appreciated that you included that concordance with current guidelines. You saw that less than half of the web pages that you reviewed had appropriate sources to support their claims. Were you surprised at all by this?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I was not surprised. So there have been, you know, studies that have looked at accuracy and have compared it to guidelines before, but we did it a little bit differently and we did different body regions. So maybe in, I guess you could say, you know, the maybe the net that we cast was a little bit larger than what some of the other studies have done that tend to focus, you know, maybe on just back pain or just knee pain. And so we did it a little bit differently there. There's some other information that we gathered that was different. But as far as adherence to guidelines, I kind of expected it to not be good. I said that example from Mayo Clinic, you know. So I think an interesting thing as we looked into this, it wasn't just that, but when we got into the references, I mean, there'd be a website like Healthline would use a tertiary source and it would cite Mayo Clinic or it would cite, you know, WebMD in their page. And then if you looked at that page, maybe they had no references. So it was this interesting kind of situation where, you know, you could propagate misinformation.
Yeah, it's a good example of how we can fall into these circular reference traps almost.
Yeah.
And then you also found that less than half of the pages you looked at had authors with a background that was easy to find and that was credible. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think out of everything in the study, this was probably the most surprising to me. I expected some physical therapists to be authors here and there, and we found zero in the study. I mean, there was a personal trainer who authored a page, a few nutritionists, not dietitians, and physicians like ophthalmologists that were authoring low back pain websites. And this is like a musculoskeletal research study. So I anticipated there would be a lot more orthopedists and maybe even a few physical therapists thrown in there, because these are what research has shown are the most knowledgeable people on musculoskeletal conditions. But that really wasn't the case. So I think it says something in, you know, as far as physical therapists, I think it speaks to the perception maybe of physical therapists and what we know. I don't know that the public understands the depth of our knowledge, I think. So, you know, maybe we can talk about it later, but I think it would be a good idea for physical therapists that have an interest in this to reach out to some of these websites and say, hey, I'm interested in, you know, authoring or editing some of this stuff.
Yeah, I guess, do you think that the reason that no physical therapists were authors on any of these were because we don't get asked to do it, or like you mentioned, because the public doesn't know really what we do, or maybe we do get asked, but people say no, or they don't see the value in it, or, you know, why do you think PTs haven't been involved in this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm not completely sure. I think there's probably, I think we probably don't get asked to do it really. And if you look at the way some of these sites are set up, and we talked about this in the study, you know, physicians that are part of developing the information that goes on a website, they have this like murky editor role. And a lot of these, in fact, I don't know that we really saw any website define what that meant, what their role was. So journalists usually wrote the web page, and then physicians would go ahead and be the quote unquote editor of that page. So if you think about probably how that's actually taking place, it's probably a journalist that comes up, you know, and doesn't know too much about the issue, and then writes it up, and then it gets sent over to a physician. And having the physician in that editor role kind of, you know, you can put their stamp of approval on the web page. And so maybe it has a little bit more credibility just on its face to the person that's reading that web page. But it's kind of like me, you know, not knowing anything about ancient Rome tomorrow, deciding that I'm going to write a web page on ancient Rome. And then I send it to a historian, but the historian's actually a historian on US presidential history, you know, and he glances through it and checks it off. That's kind of like analogous to what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that makes an interesting point that especially these days in the age of blogs and influencers and all this is that really anyone can publish anything, especially online. And, you know, to some extent, I see the obvious negatives to that, like we're discussing here, where, you know, do we really know that the person authoring or editing that is truly qualified to be speaking on that subject? But on the flip side, I also see the potential for getting information to the masses and getting quality information to people that may not be able to access it otherwise. So I think it's a bit of a catch-22. Do you have any thoughts on any of the potential positives of these websites or how we could turn this into a potential positive?
Well, I mean, the weight and the power that these websites have is mind-boggling. I mean, WebMD has 25 million visitors every month. I mean, just to think about that, it's insane. It's like half the size of France visiting WebMD each month, and there's unique visitors. So, it's huge. So there's definitely potential to influence, you know, understanding that the population has. And there is some research that shows people often do consult information from these websites. So I think we need to make, you know, with power comes great responsibility. We need to make sure that this information is accurate. So far, the steps that have taken, if any have been taken, have not been sufficient. I mean, like I said, variations on this have been done. This study have been done since the beginning of the internet, really. And it hasn't changed very much. So I think one thing, you know, that we might be able to take away from this is what if, you know, maybe we got more physical therapists involved, or what if we, you know, had orthopedists, you know, more involved with developing these. It is interesting though, because I go back and forth in my head and some of the, you know, quotes that we have in one of the tables in this paper, you know, have these ideas of the body like a car, or like the rotator cuff wears out like a tire. Don't walk on cobblestone when you have a knee replacement surgery. And some of these ideas you hear from orthopedists. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the solution is. You're right. I think it's good that we get information out there. It's great that that potential exists, but I'd like to see it be accurate information that helps people.
Agreed. I think the table with some of these misleading or fear-inducing statements is pretty jarring when you read it. Some of these examples of, like you said, the tire as the rotator cuff, and even, you know, the classic example of the jelly filling of the spinal disc herniating. I wish there were a way that we could not come to a consensus. I don't know that that's the right way to think about it, but to really do a better quality check of these things and to get the right people involved to make sure that people are getting good information. And I do think physical therapists could have a great role in this.
Yeah, I agree. As people that are non-surgical healthcare providers, I think we're kind of set up to be people that can offer good conservative advice.
Yes, definitely. So you looked at a few different conditions in this review, including ankle sprains, neck pain, whiplash, low back pain, plantar fasciitis, total knee, shoulder pain, and knee osteoarthritis or knee pain. Were you at all surprised at the difference in concordance by condition?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple surprises in there. You know, once, you know, the could be explainable once you looked at it. And so I was surprised that, you know, low back pain wasn't, you know, way down there. It was actually, if you looked at some of those sites, those, you know, it was rare that websites in general mentioned, you know, psychological factors, for example, as playing a role, but the low back pain pages were more likely to do that. So I think, you know, it surprised me, for example, like ankle sprain was one of the most one of the lowest. And I think that that has more to do with changes in guidelines that we used in terms of recommendations. So yeah, I think overall it was pretty close to what I expected, but wasn't good. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah, I was disappointed to see the low mention of psychosocial factors and even lower mention of whether someone can continue to work or what that might look like for them.
Yeah, we used, you know, that Lynn paper from, I think, 2020, where they came out with best practice recommendations for musculoskeletal care and operationalized that for this study. And I think that there were some things that you could walk away with, you know, besides the authorship for this paper, that there were a few things out of that, I think, that we could take away. Mm-hmm. And that was one of them. Psychological factors didn't get mentioned often. You know, hardly ever did they recommend people stay at work. And then if you think about who, again, is authoring these web pages, it might not be too surprising that imaging and the limitations of imaging were mentioned. So those were some of the big things that came away from that.
Yeah, I suppose I was not surprised to see the result that imaging was often kind of described as a necessary part of care in a condition. Not surprised, but you know, disappointed in that that's not always related back to the red flags.
Right. And for most musculoskeletal conditions, imaging should be used selectively. And yeah, I mean, some of the web pages really almost advocated people get imaging, which was, you know, again, you know, some of the information that they put out there just is not good. And I guess if there was one thing I was surprised about, sometimes it was how flagrant some of it was.
I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that the highest concordance with guidelines was one of the conditions was total knee arthroplasty. As I said, pleasantly surprised. I've unfortunately seen a lot of situations where patients have come in post total knee and been really afraid to use the new knee and to weight bear and to really trust it. And I think they've read some not great information. So I was really pleasantly surprised to see that.
Yeah, I think that was good. And some of these too, I mean, if it might partially have to do with the simplicity of the guidelines. So the recommendations for, you know, total knee replacement and rehab is pretty simple and not that debatable. Whereas, you know, other conditions, you know, it's not as variable, I guess, would be a good way to put it. So most people, when they think of total knee rehab, there's not too much variety. But yeah, you're right. I mean, like we talked about that table and the example of, you know, you can't walk on cobblestone after a knee replacement. I mean, just yeah, ridiculous statements. There's still some crazy stuff out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of verbiage that is really, at best, ineffective, and at worst, really damaging. So what suggestions do you have for clinicians that are seeing patients that come in saying, oh, I read this on such and such website, and either they've already developed an opinion of it and you're now having to kind of have a conversation about that, or maybe they're asking your opinion on that. How are you approaching that conversation with them?
Yeah, that's difficult. I think you probably have to ascertain how firmly held their beliefs are before you go ahead and start trying to tear them down. But I think a lot of people, if it's something that they're coming to you asking about, hey, you know, I saw this information, is it true? That might reflect that they have more trust in you than they do of the source. And a lot of people, you know, if you ask people, even though they get information from the internet, people kind of understand that the quality of information on the internet isn't very good. And so I think sometimes there's a window for you to say, okay, that's one way to think about it. And, you know, how I might think about it would be different. Or you could, you know, maybe point out what they probably already know. Hey, the quality on that site isn't the world's best. I think a lot of us have blogs on our own clinic website that hopefully could be used as resources. If not, you know, that's one way that we can make a difference, is developing our own blogs about these conditions and directing patients to those resources. or coming up with, you know, YouTube videos, things that, you know, being in places that patients go to access information, especially just the way our healthcare system is in the States. Oftentimes they'll see a primary care physician who may not know much about the condition. And then they might see an orthopedist who doesn't have much time to spend talking to them, or might have, you know, a slightly different perspective about how the body works. And so I think, you know, if they're in physical therapy and we want them to have maybe a more optimistic view, I think it makes sense to have our own resources to direct them to. And then, like I said earlier, if we could reach out to these websites and start to, you know, maybe inquire about positions that they have and, you know, see if we can volunteer ourselves, and it'd be great to do this again 10 years from now and have more physical therapists in there.
Yeah, that would be ideal. That would be amazing. I think for clinicians that operate within a large health system, I think that might also be a great opportunity to say, hey, you know, we are a public-facing entity, and can we create this resource that is public-facing for our patients or our potential patients so that they don't have to go to some of these other sources? And I agree. I think for clinicians that, like probably like you and I, that are really irked by how this is presented to the public, taking that initiative to reach out to the WebMDs of the world and really volunteering ourselves and trying to get that seat at the table is really important. So just thinking about when we want to spend energy into getting the best information out there, do we spend more of our time correcting the things that are already out there, or trying to catch those things that are already out there? Or should we focus our time and our energy on creating the more reputable, accurate resource and getting that out there?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to admit this, but I think we have to do both. We have to start going upstream and, you know, making a difference and making ourselves known to the public. What I'm really excited about when I see these new physical therapy graduates is that they seem a little bit more well-prepared to do this, you know, education directly to the public than maybe past generations have been. And so I think, you know, hopefully they're going to be well-prepared to do that. If you look back historically in physical therapy, we didn't really market to the public until, you know, I mean, even the private practice section didn't come into existence until the early 60s, you know, and they faced opposition for decades. So we didn't really take kindly to marketing to the public. We kind of cozied up to physicians forever. And so I think we have, and then I think that's part of the reason that the public doesn't have the best understanding of what physical therapy is. And so if we want that to change, it's going to take a little bit of effort, but I think we have to get out there, each one of us, and see if we can, you know, kind of change the narrative of these certain conditions and help educate the public.
Agreed. Excellent. And then we always kind of like to wrap up with asking about any, you know, projects that you might have coming up or anything that you're working on that has you excited about the profession, or anything in general that is getting you kind of excited about our profession right now.
Yeah, like I said, I think I am kind of excited about what we have to do next, which is get out there, try to get out into the media and, you know, do this direct to the patient marketing, just get out there and start to talk to people about conditions that they're dealing with for the musculoskeletal system, for the movement system, for everything that we do well as physical therapists. So I'm excited to see that change and see the APTA pivot in that direction to focusing on building a community and the social issues that we encounter and that influence our patients. So I'm definitely excited about that. You know, I'm going to present some research at the upcoming AAMP conference in October in San Diego. So that's, you know, something that I'm excited about as well, that's coming down the pipeline. And if you're in Arizona, I'm going to speak at the fall conference coming up here in October as well.
A lot to look forward to right there.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting end to the year.
And I will piggyback on what you said about this next generations of physical therapists. I think we are hopefully in a really unique position to see our new graduate physical therapist start to really take that ownership of who we are as movement system experts and movement system specialists and to bring that to the masses. And I share your excitement about this future generation.
Yeah. And as you were talking to Leanna, it made me remember that we're also working on our own podcast, the Center for Excellence in Manual and Manipulative Therapy, which Chad Cook has been spearheading out of Duke. And so there are a lot of AAMT people that are involved with that. Derek Cluley and I are going to co-host that podcast that starts soon. And I know there's a close relationship with AAMT there.
Yes. And that sounds like a great podcast that we should all have on our radar and a great resource for the profession.
Appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And please check out the show notes for any resources that we've discussed today. And we hope to see you again, Dr. Peterson.
Yeah, thanks for the time, Leanna. This has been great.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AAOMPT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AAOMPT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.